From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we explore the science of food.
Why does the texture of food change when you cook it? I do an example of an egg. A raw egg is this, you know, runny mass of white stuff, and then you cook it just a few minutes, and it turns into this solid that's no longer transparent. How did that change with just a little bit of temperature?
Then county officials help college students with mental health issues, and a photographic exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Library explores perception and blindness. And actor Patrick Wilson read American codebreaker Edwin Layton's book as preparation for his role in Midway.
And I can't say that I understood all of it when you're talking about intelligence and ciphers and code breaking. It's very intense, but was super helpful in getting a real feel for his passion and his skill set.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. I'm Bonnie North. Many of us cook every day, and we probably don't think too much about it. The once translucent egg white turns white, or the bright red steak turns brown, and we just accept that that's what food does. But humans are perhaps the only animal that actually cooks its food. Some scientists believe our ability to manipulate foodstuffs has had a profound effect on our evolution. And the science behind cooked food may be just as profound, as Professor Paul Lyman can tell you. Lyman is currently the featured speaker for UW-Milwaukee's Science Bag series. His presentation is aptly titled, Cooked, Science in the Kitchen. He sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about some of the many questions that he answers in his talk.
How does the structure change? Why does the texture of food change when you cook it? I do an example of an egg. A raw egg is this, you know, runny mass of white stuff, and then you cook it just a few minutes, and it turns into this solid that's no longer transparent. How did that change with just a little bit of temperature? Why does raw meat, it doesn't really appeal to us too much, but put it on a barbecue for a while, and I want to eat it.
It is interesting because we're one of the only animals that actually cooks our food. And, you know, as you mentioned, a raw egg does not hold a lot of appeal. Eggs themselves are pretty fascinating.
Oh, they are.
The white part especially, you know, you just talked about this, but it goes from being this kind of translucent, kind of soggy mess into a hard, opaque substance.
Yes.
How does that happen?
Well, it's mostly water in the egg white, but there's about 10% of it are proteins. Proteins are kind of long chains of certain kind of molecules called amino acids. Amino acids are sort of like the Legos of biochemistry. String them together and you form a long protein. Proteins are interesting because they have a long chain that's very strong along the chain, but then it folds up upon itself in ways that's dictated by that sequence of amino acids. Anyway, in the egg, proteins are coiled up into these little bundles, and they're so small when they're bundled up like that that they don't scatter light. That is, the egg is still transparent. And just a little bit of cooking, those little coils of proteins uncoil, and they stretch out like filaments, and then there's enough of them that they bond to each other and make a kind of a network out of these adjacent uncoiled proteins. That net captures the water and so basically makes water droplets dispersed within this protein network. That's what gives it its firmness.
So the proteins, essentially, they're these little guys that are all coiled up. And when you add heat, they're like, oh, I'm going to stretch out. I gotta lounge out.
Yeah, that's right. But you can never put the genie back in the bottle. You can never coil those proteins back up.
You can't uncook an egg.
You can't uncook an egg.
So when we're looking at an egg, we obviously have the white portion, the kind of protein around another little package of protein, but they're very different. And, you know, anybody who's separated an egg can tell you it's not that difficult to take the yolk out of the white. These are two very different substances.
That's right. They are. I mean, they're both largely protein and water. The yolk, it's about half fat and protein and half water, whereas the white is like 90% water. Most of the action for the developing embryo would be in the yolk. And the yolk is basically food for the developing embryo. The white is eventually food for the developing embryo, but mostly it's packaging. Mostly it's cushioning, protection. So most of the action comes from the yellow.
So yolks are part of a process that occurs in a lot of different types of food. Emulsion. How does that work?
Yes, emulsions, it's putting one substance into another that don't normally mix. So oil and water would be the classic example. If anybody's ever tried to mix oil and water, you know that they separate. An emulsion is you get tiny little drops of, say, oil spread throughout the water. Normally, it would just separate out, but there's ways to stabilize that little droplet called an emulsifier. The most common example is soap. You have oil on your hands. You go and run that under a sink. You know, you still have oily hands. But if you put some soap on it, what you're doing is creating these small structures called micelles. That's a big word. Let me back that up. What is soap? It is a molecule that looks like water on one end of it and looks like fat or oil on the other end of it. And so if you put a number of these soap molecules into water, what they do is they form these little almost shell-like structures called micelles. And so the oily parts hang out with the oily parts and the water parts hang out with the water parts in this little shell. Well, an oil droplet can fit inside there. And so that's a way of dispersing oil within water. So that's what happens when you wash your hands, but that's also what happens if you make mayonnaise.
Yeah, anybody who has seen mayonnaise made, it's eggs and then it's oil. And they both start as this kind of semi-translucent substance. And then as you mix them together, they become this very thick white mayonnaise.
You know how you could have ice and it's perfectly clear? Snow is the same thing, but it's opaque. Why is that? It has to do with that you have a mixture of two things. In snow, you have air and water, ice. The ice of a snowflake is clear, but then the light goes through air and then through ice and then through air and then through ice, and it's that change from one substance to the other that causes the light to be deflected in different directions. So now if you imagine trying to shine a flashlight through a bunch of snow, it gets deflected a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, and eventually it doesn't come out at all. It scatters back, and that's what we perceive as white. Same thing happens in mayonnaise. It's these little globs of fat, little globs of water, and the light gets deflected a little to the left, a little to the right, and your mayonnaise looks white.
What are some other common examples of emulsions that, you know, we might be either drinking or eating on a daily basis?
Well, salad dressing is a pretty good example. So again, it's oil and vinegar. And if you try and mix them up at the restaurant, they separate. But we put some emulsifiers in them to stabilize it. Egg yolk is a very good example of one. And that's where you get Caesar salad dressing from. But it's very fortunate that there are some other emulsifiers which happen to be delicious. So garlic and mustard both happen to have very good emulsification properties. That is, they have molecules that are kind of like soap, except they're tasty. You put some mustard in your oil and vinegar and shake it up, and it's more stable.
Another emulsion that I didn't realize was an emulsion is milk. That's something that you talk about in your presentation.
That's right. So a growing baby needs all kinds of nutrients, right? And so you need protein, you need fat, you need water. So how did we evolve to deliver all those in one substance? Well, it's done again through an emulsion. Milk is mostly water, but there's a lot of protein, 10% protein and 4% fat. And those fat globules are dispersed through the milk. Proteins in there and a couple of varieties. There's casein, and then there's other proteins which are called whey proteins.
Well, and these are all terms that come up in the cheesemaking process. As you mentioned, casein is something that's inside of milk just in general, and whey is something that's inside of milk. And when you get into the cheesemaking process, these are things that seem to kind of separate. How does that happen?
That's right. So an emulsion is when you get these things mixed together, but as a cook, you may have come across a time when you break an emulsion, and that means it separates into the two component parts. So if you were to shake up oil and vinegar, you make temporarily an emulsion, but it will break. It'll separate into two parts. Well, making cheese is breaking that emulsion. It's a complicated process for cheese. There's these little structures of casein proteins, and they all carry a negative electrical charge. That's important because they repel one another. So these substances would ordinarily like to be together because they're chemically similar, but they have this electrical charge that keeps them separated. In the stomach of a calf, there's a substance called rennet. It's an enzyme, and that's just another fancy word that means something that helps a chemical reaction to happen. In this case, it goes in and it clips off the protein off the casein cluster that carries that negative charge. And it does it very efficiently, very fast. The result is that all these formerly negatively charged caseins are now neutral. And now they like to bond to each other. And so they bond to each other and form a network. It's almost like making a fishing net. And they capture all the things that are not water, all the fats and other proteins. The result is that the milk breaks up into cheese curds. I'm sure you've heard of cheese curds. So this is where it comes from. It breaks up into cheese curds on one hand and liquid whey, basically the water and some of the sugars and some of the proteins, separate out into the other phase. And so you used to have homogeneous milk, and now you have clumps of white semi-solids and almost clear liquid.
Is it appropriate to say that the rennet partially digests parts of that milk in order to separate it?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to say it. It certainly aids in the digestion as far as the calf is concerned.
So when it does that, we have what we may commonly call whey, and then we have curds. And a lot of the time, these curds are going to be just that kind of soft cheese that we eat right away. How do we get from something that is a curd and a soft kind of cheese into the harder cheeses like a cheddar or a Swiss?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So as you point out, yes, all cheese kind of starts out in that way of making these soft cheese curds. But then the cheesemaker can go all kinds of different directions. You can leave them more or less in that soft form and cook them a little bit and make a stringy cheese, mozzarella. Or you can take those curds and put them into a mold and drain yet more and more of the liquid out, more and more of the water out. And you can add substances to make it more tasty. Salt. All the cheeses are salted pretty much. But then a lot of the heavy lifting is done by bacteria or yeast. Blue cheese, for instance, has a, I suppose it's a mold, and it modifies the cheese curds and creates these various aroma compounds and flavor compounds, some of which we find delicious, some of which we don't. Some of these are acquired tastes. Also, there's changes that just happen over time due to the substances within the cheese itself, like the rennet, continues to alter the fats and proteins within the cheese.
And there's one reaction in particular that a lot of people credit as being the thing that makes food delicious, and it's called the Maillard reaction.
Yeah, Maillard reaction.
Maillard reaction.
And again, I personally say Maillard. Probably a French-speaking person would probably be cringing. But earlier when I was talking about cooking eggs, I talked about the proteins uncoiling. But the proteins were not damaged in that process. That is, the chain was not broken. In the Maillard reaction, the chain is broken. So we have a protein which is, again, made up of these things called amino acids. And if you have sugar around, the sugar and the protein molecule reacts and basically makes a chemical reaction that breaks the protein into smaller pieces. It makes them into hundreds of smaller pieces. But for whatever reason, the compounds it gives off are delicious smelling. They're smaller, and so they can become vaporized, that is, you can smell them. And so these little bits come off, and they're very flavorful. This is what you smell when you smell baking bread. This is what you smell when you smell roasting coffee. This is what you smell when you barbecue meat. So Maillard reactions are browning reactions. You know, all the things I just mentioned turns out to be that the substance turns brown. There are other browning reactions, but focusing on these ones where the proteins are broken and they create volatile, delicious smelling compounds that we all know from cooking.
So something that undergoes the Maillard reaction in order to become, you know, what we find delicious, but also has a lot of other stuff going on inside is bread. there's a lot of conversation about gluten, especially because a lot of people have different issues with gluten. But the structures are really fascinating. What's happening when bread is being first kind of mixed together?
Yeah. So when you grind wheat, there are small segments of a protein called glutilin and glutenin. Collectively, we'll just call them glutens. They're chains of proteins that are a certain length. But what's interesting is they're like Legos. When they're exposed to water and oxygen, they link together at the ends. Very quickly, they react together. And so what used to be a moderately long molecule becomes an extremely long molecule. They're also kind of elastic, kind of stretchy, because before and after they're linked up, there's coils and kinks along the length of this chain. So I would say think of a slinky. They're coiled up. But then once we add water and oxygen, they bind together. So it's like you took three slinkies and made them longer and then longer and longer and longer. Now, as you're kneading the dough, what you're doing is stretching out those chains of gluten. And then you know how dough then kind of retracts after you knead it. What's going on there is those coils and kinks are retracting, just like a slinky would. So if you keep working at this, what you do is you're cross-linking all of these different filaments of gluten. Again, if you had a whole bunch of slinkies and you were put them in a washing machine or something, you know, it would be a tangled mess. Well, that's what you're doing when you knead bread. You're making this tangled mess. If you continue to knead it, it actually develops into sheets of gluten. These gluten sheets are what trap the bubbles of steam when you bake bread. And that's what allows bread to rise. Otherwise, if the gas just went out, the bread wouldn't rise. Think about when you make pancakes. There, you have not developed a gluten network. And so those bubbles that come to the surface, they get away, and your pancake doesn't rise very much.
Which is what you kind of want from a pancake.
That's what you want from a pancake. So there are times that you want this gluten network. If you like, want a nice crusty piece of bread or a nice roll that you can sink your teeth in, you want it to be tough and to have some resistance and to puff up when you bake it.
Well, and that gets to the idea of kneading and over-kneading. And that's something I know bakers have to deal with all of the time. It really depends on what you're making, how much you need to knead it. And I know that there's a structural difference that you talk about between something like bread or something like a pastry, the kinds of desserts that we eat.
That's right. Sometimes you want it to be crumbly and flaky. And what you need to do then is to not allow that gluten network to form so well. The way to do that is to control the reaction of linking those gluten molecules up by introducing a fat. So before you add the water, you put fat, often butter, in. If you've baked a pie, you've cut butter into flour. What that butter is doing is changing the gluten so that it can't react into these long filaments. The other thing it does is it kind of binds to the outside of the filament. So even if you do have a filament, it can't bind to the next gluten molecule. So it becomes more tender, friable. In fact, this is just a coincidence, but we say we add shortening. What you're doing when you have shortening is you're shortening the length of the gluten molecules.
Professor Lyman, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Paul Lyman is a physics professor at UW-Milwaukee. He's the featured speaker for this month's Science Bag series. Lyman spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about his presentation entitled Cooked: Science in the Kitchen. You can go to WUWM.com to find dates and times for Lyman's next presentation. Coming up next, how county officials are hoping to increase awareness about mental health issues among the area's college-age students. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Depression, anxiety, and other mental health issues are a growing concern for college students and young people as a whole. Demand for counseling services at University of Wisconsin campuses has increased by more than 50% since 2010. According to the World Health Organization, most lifetime mental disorders manifest before the age of 24. Psychologists with the Milwaukee County Behavioral Health are looking to increase awareness about the importance of prevention and early detection. Dr. Stephen Dykstra and Dr. Maria Elena Perez tell WUWM's education reporter Emily Files that spotting signs of mental illness early can connect patients to treatment sooner and lessen the severity of the diagnosis.
And one of the things we've recognized is that when young people go off to college, they face certain stresses, they face certain challenges, they leave certain supports and familiar surroundings. And this can oftentimes be the time that these mental illnesses sometimes start to emerge when they're away from home, when they're not in the company of people who know them well. And in some cases, that can really delay and disrupt identifying those challenges and getting them their earliest, best possible care.
Dr. Perez, what are some of the most common mental health challenges that students in the college age range deal with?
Well, I would say certainly between the ages of 18 to 22, maybe 25, we see a great deal of depression, anxiety, and also complicated by trauma. We see a great deal of traumatic stress disorders oftentimes. Oftentimes, these symptoms, these mental health problems, are there well before the age of 18, and they start to surface as one is, emerging into an early adulthood. That's a very common observation we make.
There was some recent discussion with the UW Board of Regents about the major increase in demand for behavioral health services at UW campuses. There's this question of, is it because mental health issues in college students are becoming increasingly common, or is it because there is less stigma about seeking help?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think that mental health problems have been around for forever and a day. But fortunately, I think that there is some movement that we see in our culture with regards to destigmatizing mental illness. We still have a ways to go, I think. But I do see that young people are very receptive to being more open about talking about what they struggle with.
So how do you distinguish between just the normal anxiety that young people who are in college or in the workforce or just at that point in their lives when they are trying to figure out who they are as an adult? How do you distinguish that kind of normal anxiety from a more serious mental health challenge?
Where we start to distinguish normal from what we call clinically significant is when symptoms start to interfere with work performance, academic performance.
Yeah, I fully agree. The key is to be able to recognize that this is affecting your life in a way that is unusual compared to other people. It's very appropriate to worry about your midterms. It's less appropriate to worry about your midterms all the time for weeks and weeks before they come up. It's even less appropriate if you keep worrying about them for weeks and weeks after they happened. You're not sleeping. You can't get along with people. It's starting to interfere in your life. You're not enjoying yourself anymore. People would notice that you're not really yourself. That's a worry that's gone too far.
So what should a student do if they're not sure whether the anxiety or sadness that they're feeling is something that needs, you know, professional help or treatment, or if it's something that they just are going to be able to power through and it's just something that a lot of people are feeling?
The default answer to that is really encouraging young people to reach out and talk to a friend or someone on college campus. I know our colleges are, they're fortified, and they really are raising awareness on campuses that can help to determine whether or not it's exceeding what we would consider normal.
You know, the challenge of that question is that for you to notice it in yourself, you have to have kind of not lost perspective. And sometimes one of the casualties of these kinds of concerns and issues is that you lose that perspective on yourself. Which is where, as Dr. Perez was pointing out, it's so important that somebody around you has the kindness, the courage, the wherewithal, the opportunity to sort of step in and say, hey, I'm worried about you.
So tell me more about what your recommendations are in terms of early detection. You're talking about how when you do have a mental health issue, you might not be able to recognize it in yourself. How does early detection happen before, you know, it's too late to recognize that?
Well, one of the things I hope people monitor in themselves and watching each other is, you know, some real basic things about ourselves. If you don't feel happy anymore, you don't feel as happy as you used to, it's harder to feel happy. The other thing is there's a whole sort of category of mental illnesses that while they are rare, they are quite serious, and they often begin during these years or get substantially worse during these years. So if you find yourself having unusual thoughts or fears, you find yourself preoccupied with things that it occurs to you aren't maybe real. Those aren't common. Those aren't common experiences, but when they occur, they can be a sign of something quite serious. So, you know, if you are having those experiences or you know somebody who's having those experiences, reach out to somebody and let them know.
What are some of those mental illnesses that are more serious and more rare that tend to manifest during the college age years?
So the two big ones that we'd be talking about are various forms of psychosis, or for instance, forms of bipolar disorder, or the one that, you know, maybe strikes the most concern in people's hearts and minds is something called schizophrenia, which is widely misunderstood, is more common than people realize. And then sort of related disorders where people don't have either of those, but they may have sort of bits and pieces, sort of signs and symptoms of those things, which can affect them more at some times and less at others. Things that cause people to sort of see the world differently than other people do to a degree that makes it harder for them to fit in. The onset of those illnesses and the period of time when they either start or make it dramatically worse just happens to line up biologically and chronologically with about the same period of time in people's lives. So people are moving out of mom and dad's house. They're getting their own first apartment. They're going off to college. They're starting a job. Sometimes at the same time that these things are starting, and it makes it harder to notice them.
So what about the Milwaukee County Behavioral Health Services that are out there? When would you suggest a student seeking out something outside of their campus?
You know, if what's going on in your campus doesn't seem to be enough, if things are getting more severe and they're getting severe fast, there's one particular category of services that Milwaukee County offers to everybody in Milwaukee County, regardless of why you're here, and that is crisis services. If things have gotten very dark, very bleak, you're thinking about hurting yourself, hurting somebody else, you're not sure if you're going to make it till morning, you're just overwhelmed, it's devastating for you. We have numbers from Milwaukee County that you can call, and there's somebody will always talk to you. If they need to come to you, somebody will always come to you. I think one of the other things to know is that family members who are away from these young adults, because their children have moved away or they're in another community now or they're off at college, they can call, they can reach out, they can seek assistance. I encourage them not to do that behind somebody's back, you know, to be as open about that as you can possibly be. You know, we're here to listen to people and to help everybody as much as possible.
Psychologists Stephen Dykstra and Maria Elena Perez with the Milwaukee County Behavioral Health Wraparound Services spoke with WUWM's education reporter, Emily Files. Coming up next, we visit the Milwaukee Public Library's main branch to see a photographic exhibit there called My Heart Is Not Blind. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that conversation in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Just past the front desk of the Milwaukee Public Library's Central Branch on West Wisconsin Avenue, there's a hallway that you have to walk through to get to the stacks. Through the end of November, that hallway will be lined with a series of striking black and white photographic portraits. Called My Heart Is Not Blind, the exhibition is made up of photographs, a book, and audio recordings by Texas photographer Michael Nye. The exhibition was brought to Milwaukee by Wisconsin's Vision Forward, a nonprofit group that works with people who have experienced vision loss. I met Nye at the Central Branch to see the photographs and learn more about them. Nye says that while he's been working on the show for the past 7 years, he really started thinking about it almost 3 decades ago.
I was in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, the capital. I was on an Arts America tour and had an exhibit at the capital. And the curator said, Michael, would you take a group of international blind students around and talk about your photographs? I didn't think much about it. And I will never forget, Bonnie, their attention, their resolute gaze. This was like a whisper could travel forever. And I just have never talked to a group of people that listened so intently and with purpose. And all of a sudden, they start asking questions. Why are you a photographer? What do these photographs mean? What's beautiful that's non-visual? How does anyone, blind or sighted, understand the world outside themselves? I mean, just really questions about what do you do in your life? What do you know? What does it mean to be human? What can you expect from the future? Those kinds of deep philosophical questions. And I remember that night, I just stayed up all night writing in my journal just about the nature of perception, how deep it is, how mysterious it is. So I did other projects. I spent 4.5 years interviewing people with mental illness. I spent 4.5 years interviewing people that are hungry around the country. Those exhibits have traveled extensively. But I came back to this one because I wanted the conversations. And I spent 7 years on this project. And I spent 2 to 4 to 5 days with each person. So they're deep, substantive, intimate conversations about their lives and about their altered perception.
Were all of them blind their entire lives, or was there a mix?
Well, I think that's one of the confusing aspects with the public. There's no experience the same. Some people are born blind. Some people are blind at 6, 19, 80. There are people that go blind in a second, like a car bomb or hit by a train. They're in this exhibit, shot in the face. Or others, long-term, retinitis pigmentosa, rod and cone dystrophy, choroideremia, where it's gradual, sometimes 5 years, 20 years. It's a gradual loss of sight. And then blindness is different the first year than it is the 7th year or the 20th year or the 60th year. And it's different if you have support, if you have family that understands, that you have education, that you have training, mobility. And then if you're visually impaired, it's incredibly complicated, near extreme, near blindness, near... And that's almost like living between two worlds, not really in the blind world, but not also in the sighted world. So, and then also whatever disease or injury they have is a different experience. So every story is personal and unique and uninvited.
Sight is it's the sense that I think most of us rely on the most. And I think the one losing, if we were thinking about losing a sense, that was the one that would scare us the most to lose. I've been so nearsighted all of my life that when I take my glasses off, it's like an impressionist painting. So I know what it's like not to see well, but I'm not visually impaired to the extent of that I can't drive or anything like that. But I think it's one of those things. And here we are, we're talking in the medium of radio, which is all about hearing. And there are times when you hear better, of course, when you close your eyes. And so that's one of the things that fascinated me about this whole project. And the fact that it was happening in a library.
Yes,
yeah,
in a library. It makes me think about... this man by the name of Jacques Lusseron, he was French, and he was blind at 8, and he was a resistant fighter and one of the leaders, blind leader. And he said something which is very revelatory about this whole situation. He said, as much as we need our eyesight and how important it is for our evolution and the survival, there's a cost to everything in life, and the cost of eyesight is the detriment of our other senses. That's true. That's really true. And I think the public, when they think of blindness, they think of darkness, blackness. And they imagine, well, if I went blind, I couldn't do anything that I'm doing now. I couldn't do the work I'm doing now. But what they don't understand, the calculus they never understand, it's so hard to say this, is that adaptation. What a powerful thing human beings can do. It's not just learning differently. Your brain can rewire itself to favor non-visual thinking and orientation. It's like another language. It's like learning Chinese. One day you wake up and you start dreaming. And the individuals that I have met, many, 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 that had sight and lost their sight, I'd say 90% wouldn't take their sight back if it was offered to them, because they've adapted and the brain's rewired itself. And that's one of the things that the public doesn't get. It's not helplessness. It's not akin to death. It's not being buried alive. It's not a life of misery. It's not the end of the world. It shouldn't define you. But with the right education, with the right training, with the right skills, with the right resources, with the right opportunities and the right attitude, the right motivation, you can do anything being blind after you've adapted. At first, it's horrible and terrible, and you can imagine, but people adapt, and they adapt to their situation. It's amazing. It's such an interesting conversation.
In the 30 years that you've been thinking about this project and working with this, has it helped you see better yourself or differently, maybe?
I have probably every week for the last at least 6 years have blindfolded myself, maybe 20 minutes once a week, just to experience listening better. It's nothing like blindness. Of course not. And I haven't adapted. But just to listen, it's amazing what you hear when you don't see. It's like your brain all of a sudden is in control saying, okay, what's going on here? And you start listening different. And you hear, you know, footsteps, and you hear car motors and the water being turned on in the next room, and you hear voices somewhere, and you hear yourself breathing, and touch is different, not just with your fingertips, but with your whole body. Also, I found out that almost everyone that's been blind long-term has developed echolocation. It's kind of a sonar. It's not amazing. It's very common, and that is sound bouncing off things. It's like an anatomy of sound, or a tapestry, or a fingerprint. You can tell when you're by a building. You can tell when there's a parked car coming up, or a tree, or an open room, or how high the ceiling is.
Because the air changes.
The air changes, the sound changes, the distance you are to an object changes. Some people are better than others, but some people don't even know they do it. But it's something that we all have the ability to do if we paid attention to it.
As you've put this exhibit together, and this is not the first place it's been, right? I mean, this,
right.
It's traveling around
yes.
the country. What has been the reaction of the people that you photographed and with whom you spoke? How do they perceive what this exhibit is?
Well, I was a little insecure. I mean, I'm not blind. Why would I do a project saying something about their lives? And so I've tried to be like an extra in a movie, or be kind of invisible in some ways. And so I worked with every single person, played their audio, sent them there's a book which is different than the audio, because you can edit audio, you edit audio different than you do text. And so worked really carefully and asked everyone, does this represent our conversation? Does this have a fidelity to, you know, what we talked about? And I think this exhibit is unique because I didn't have an agenda. No one asked me to do it. It was wanting to have conversations, and it's their voice. It's their experience. A young man, 25 years old, working for Exxon, electrician, going home at 11 o'clock at night and gets hit by a train, and it drags him down, and he wakes up in the hospital and he's blind. I think he was really different than almost anyone I met, because he said, okay, I've got 3 children, what can I do? I've got to do something with my life. And he starts getting mobility training, because you have to. How do you read? How do you write? How do you think? You know? And so he started repairing cars in the middle of the night. People would take his car because he knew how to do it. He was a car mechanic. And so people would drive their car in the middle of the night. He'd take off you know, all kinds of parts and repair them. And his wife, he said, still took out a flashlight. Even knowing that he was blind, she still would take out a flashlight. It has changed me. You asked me about seeing. You know, photographs are made in the present, but they're always about the past. And they're inherently ambiguous. I mean, that's the nature of photographs, is that it's susceptible to many, many interpretations or meaning. And there's an aesthetic to art, how light and darkness can come together and be incredibly beautiful in some ways. But there's many things that are beautiful that are non-visual. Just the tone of a voice, a handshake, the way people treat you. You know, on and on and on. They're, you know, it's surely not limited to the visual world.
What are you hoping that the people who have vision, who see this exhibit, who come to the library, and the way it's set up is you walk through it to get to the main area, so you can't help but interact with it in some way. What do you hope that they get from it?
Well, it opened at the Witte Museum in San Antonio. It's a really large, beautiful museum, and they had 25,000 to 30,000 people that went through the exhibit during the 3 months it was there. And they had a panel of individuals that were blind in the exhibit that talked. They had seniors and juniors in high school, 850 that came and had talks and research and went in the exhibit. And they had different lectures from people. But, you know, stories are windows into a larger life than our own. They are, and sometimes they can liberate us. They can remove the boundaries between ourselves and others. You can find out things. I mean, both of us are readers. We went to libraries as children, and you find other people that have lived. You find mentors that you never knew. And, you know, I really have loved the quote from E.O. Wilson, one of my heroes. He's a biologist, philosopher, sociologist. And he said, I love this quote. I went to a lecture at Trinity University, and he said, "We're drowning in information. At the same time, we're starving for wisdom. Information's easy, wisdom takes time." That's true. And it takes time to listen, it takes time to tell a story. And I think this exhibit, not me, but the individual speaking, it is thick in wisdom. It's dripping in wisdom. There are, you know, very profound things that are said. And it's almost like the dialectical process. If you're with someone and you talk for 5 hours over 3 days or 7 hours, things just emerge that surprise you. And I think that's a nice thing about deep conversation.
And so you're hoping that people have that deep conversation with this exhibit?
Well, I think the discrimination against people that are blind is horrible. It's just pernicious. It's not intentional, but it is really a misconception. Can you imagine being blind? I ought to read Katie's really interesting thing from Katie Kim, who's in the exhibit, but she looks like a mermaid. I met her in Honolulu. And she went blind over 2 days, and she went to the Ho'o Center for the Blind in Honolulu. And that word in Hawaii means to make things right. I love that word. And so she met a man there that just went blind too. He was a deep sea fisherman. He's also in the exhibit. He was out 250 miles in the Pacific Ocean and had double retina detachments and went blind. And he almost committed, you know, he locked himself in a room and tried to get into fights and hit stone walls. But they both adapted. And now their entrepreneurs have 131 people working for them in food services and have a condo right there at Waikiki at Diamond Head overlooking the ocean. They swim every single day. This exhibit's about our shared humanity and our shared fragility. I think we all share both of those sense of qualities in our lives. And it's about adaptation, about perception, about understanding. So I hope people listen, and I hope they have a deeper understanding about the lives of others.
Michael Nye, I want to thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us on this very oral medium that we're talking on, and I so appreciate your time.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Michael Nye created the My Heart is Not Blind exhibition. It's sponsored by Wisconsin's Vision Forward Association. The photographs and audio recordings are on the main floor of the central branch of the Milwaukee Public Library, and they're there through the end of November. You can learn more at WUWM.com. We will take one last break, and then film contributor Ryan Jay talks with actor Patrick Wilson about his newest film, Midway. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Patrick Wilson is the kind of actor you might recognize but just can't name. He started out in musical theater on Broadway before breaking big in movies like The Phantom of the Opera, The Conjuring series, and Aquaman. You can currently see Wilson playing American codebreaker Edwin Layton in the World War II action drama Midway. The film centers on the Battle of Midway, a battle between the American fleet and the Imperial Japanese Navy that marked a turning point in the Pacific theater. Lake Effect film contributor Ryan Jay recently spoke with Wilson about it.
So, Patrick Wilson, you know, Midway is not a typical biopic focusing on just one individual, but there's many true American heroes from World War II that we see. And aside from kind of looking like him, though, did you do any personal research into Edwin Layton for this role?
I did, yeah. There's a fantastic book called And I Was There that he wrote towards the end of his life, sadly, in the 80s, which is probably why he wasn't featured in the 76 movie, because as most intelligence folks will tell you, they keep that stuff pretty close to their vest. So a lot of the information that we have in the film, even his relationship with the Japanese, specifically with Admiral Yamamoto, was taken directly from his book. So that was pretty exciting it's a very dense book, and I can't say that I understood all of it when you're talking about intelligence and ciphers and code breaking, and it's very intense, but was super helpful in getting a real feel for his passion and his skill set during this time.
And your character kind of saves the day, you know, going with a combination of knowledge and instinct. How does that compare to what you know he actually contributed to the war effort?
Well, I think it's pretty fair to say he and his team, that was the real reason that we won, to be quite honest mm-hmm. with you, at least that we got the jump on the Japanese. I mean, not taking anything away from, the guys that actually went out and did the fighting. Of course, each of those men and women were those pilots specifically did an unbelievable job. And there's a series of just skillful moves and luck that you see in the film that really contributed. But when you're starting from even the idea that, where are they coming? How can we get ahead of them? I mean, that was really on Layton and Rochefort and his team. Mm-hmm. And relaying that to Nimitz, and then Nimitz having the courage to believe his men over Washington.
Right. Speaking of Nimitz, yeah. This cast is an amazing ensemble. It's been so much fun. You shared a lot of scenes with Woody Harrelson as Nimitz, and both kind of are chameleons yeah. in your careers. Do you have any fun behind-the-scenes story you can share about Woody?
Well, I have plenty behind the scenes. Sorry, Woody's just fantastic. Both the strength and the humor that he brings to Nimitz, I think, are just really ground the movie and give it. You know, we talk about if you're playing somebody very serious, you want to find the humor, find the light moments that really make the character dynamic, and he's the king of that. Like most of these stories, they're like ships passing in the night with these other actors, because depending on whose scenes you're in, Woody and I did spend a fair amount of time together, mm-hmm. and we just tried not to make each other laugh too much, because there are a lot of blown takes.
I can only imagine. I have to just switch gears for a quick second, take advantage of getting the chance to talk with you and let you know Conjuring 2 is one of my favorite horror films ever. I'm psyched
nice.
For the third one, but I think I love it so much probably because you sang in it. And I know you have musical roots. Right. I loved you also in Phantom of the Opera, the movie. And when are we going to see you sing on screen again?
Oh, boy, I don't know. It'd be fun, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying. I'm looking at it. I'm looking at a few things.
They're putting together Wicked, the movie, just so you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a little long in the tooth for a Fiero.
No, no.
Yeah, that's not really happening.
Back to Midway, though. There's really great, you know, balance between drama and action in this film, and you've certainly done both in your career. Which is more fun for you as an actor?
Oh, you know, it's usually where I am in my life right now. I think when I've done some bunch of serious stuff, I want to go off and do a comedy, and vice versa. There's no real rhyme or reason. I try not to. I think if I relish too much in, oh, I love this type of movie, then that's all I would do. So I, even with the horror films that I do, I try to at least make them different. So there's, because I don't like doing the same thing twice.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, I just love how in Midway it really shows the opposing side and humanizes the Japanese as well as what's going on with Americans. There are never really any real winners in war, right?
No. No, there's not. And I think that's the thing that really Roland really wanted to key into. I mean, look, we have a German director. I think that needs to be said. I mean, he pursued his own American dream, Roland Emmerich has. And I think what you see in the film is the other side. I think that's very, very important to see. And for me, the most emotional moments of the movie are on the Japanese side. And that was something with Leighton. He was an extreme patriot and so proud of his country and would die for his country 100%. That didn't mean that he also loved Japan. His time in Japan was fluent in Japanese. So I think in a strange way, that for me shows a real patriot that, yes, you believe in your country, but you also understand your place in the world and you understand the other side. And he did have that relationship with, even though it was brief, with Yamamoto. That was real. So that to me was important, and I'm so glad they kept that in there because it's important to see that there's not such a distance of, oh, there's such disdain for the enemy. I think there's an understanding there, and I think that actually, so of course when the cost of life comes into it, that's just, it's even more tragic.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Patrick Wilson, as
no problem.
Edwin Layton in Midway, playing now in theaters. It's great. Check it out.
Lake Effect film contributor Ryan Jay is a film critic who's nationally syndicated on radio and can be seen locally on today's TMJ4 every Friday and Saturday. He spoke with actor Patrick Wilson, who stars in Midway, and it's now playing in theaters. And that wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. All Things Considered comes your way next. It's 4 o'clock.